The mayor of Florida's largest African-American community shares his thoughts on improving policing. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert believes that most of the people who wear a badge should be policing the cities they live in. He joins us to discuss the national movement for justice and police reform. Also,
the message has to be clear to people who are coming anywhere, but namely to our cities right now. You can't do that anymore. You know, the party is over.
COVID cases are on the rise in Florida, but that's not stopping reopening efforts. WLRN's Katie Switalski reported a story for the show Reveal that compares Florida and California through the crisis. Finally, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in support of protections for LGBTQ employees. How will that be felt here in South Florida? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Cities across the country are grappling with how to reform their police departments to hold officers accountable and to prevent violence against Black communities. Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert argues their city has been a leader in this front. The city gives hiring preference to candidates with a local address. Now, at least 50% of his officers are Black. Some advocates say those reforms are not enough. Mayor Gilbert joins us now, and we're going to take your questions. We should note, by the way, that Mayor Gilbert is running for Miami-Dade County Commission District 1. His opponent is activist Sabrina Fulton, mother of Trayvon Martin, and we've invited her to join us on this program as well at a later date. Mayor Gilbert, thanks again for your time.
It's a pleasure being here. Thank you.
So last week, you sent a message of support to the Black Lives Matter movement by putting up digital billboard displays. Tell me about them.
You know what? We did it on the morning that George Floyd was being laid to rest. And we worked with our digital billboard providers in Miami Gardens to put up a message that it said Black Lives Matter. But the picture was of some young kids from our park. They play football at, I think it's Carroll City, the Chiefs program. And we wanted to put a picture for people who are driving by in Miami Gardens to actually see the Black lives that we're talking about. A lot of times, through media and other ways, you get this idea of who you think is involved in this. We want our kids to be safe. We want to be safe when we're coming and going from work. We want to be safe when we're leaving the store or jogging, whatever it is. We want to be safe. And we definitely shouldn't be subject to violence just because we're Black. And we definitely shouldn't be subject to violence at the hands of law enforcement, the people we're supposed to protect and service.
And why did you decide to put pictures of children up there?
Well, I think because I wanted to show you that we want the same things for our children that you want for yours. Everyone wants their children to be safe. If you have children, you want them to be safe. I know of no community that doesn't value the safety of their kids. And we didn't just put it up. We put it up at 8:46 in the morning, and we left it up for 8 minutes and 46 seconds to illustrate how long that is for someone's knee to be on someone's neck.
What kind of response did you get?
We got good response from the community. In some respects, we got, I get the threatening calls here at the office. The guy who tells me that all lives matter and he'll come down here and show me that. Listen, I appreciate his opinion, but we don't need to remind everybody about all lives. It seems that we need to remind people about Black lives. So we need to make sure that we're policing in a way that doesn't allow for that type of interaction. And if it does, then we need to have systems that hold people accountable. And so we'll talk a lot about, you know, what we've done in Miami Gardens with the hiring preference. You know, it's funny that interestingly, 13% of law enforcement nationally are Black. In Miami Gardens, it's over 50%. And it's because I decided we were going to have a policy that we gave preference to people who actually lived in Miami Gardens.
And I want to talk about this program and how you've done it and what you think policing should look like. Again, I'm talking with Mayor Gilbert from Miami Gardens about police reform. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can email us a comment or question, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Or if you want, call in, because we'd like to hear your thoughts, 800-743-9576. Again, 800-743-9576. 9576. So, Mayor, days after the protests over police brutality began in South Florida, you spoke at a news conference and you said this: we must not be back in this place again. What do you mean by that?
Well, we find ourselves here over and over again. What happens is, the cycle is, something really horrific and happens, and we protest and everyone gets angry. And then people in the media stop paying attention, and the president makes a speech about something else, or something else, you know, commands the news cycle, and we don't really do anything about it. And so there's never any translation from outrage to outcomes. And so if the problem is systemic, then how are we going to address the systems? So we have to be committed, and that's a policy fix. And sometimes it's difficult to have policy conversations when everyone's on edge and everyone's back into their different silos and they're back into their corners and everyone wants to come out fighting, because it's difficult to listen to each other when you're yelling at each other. It's difficult to understand what someone else's opinion is when you're baptized in the righteousness of your own thoughts. You need to be able to listen, and we need to be able to have that conversation in a space that moves us forward so that we're not doing this again. And let me be clear about something. No matter what we do with regard to our systems, there are going to be people who they're going to be bad actors. There are going to be people who are going to do stuff wrong. But part of the system has to be the ability to hold them accountable and get them out of the system.
So we talk about accountability. Part of the other part of this conversation, you've touched on it, but we hear it a lot. We've heard it a lot these last few weeks. It's this trust. Trust between the police and the community. So how do you build that? How did you build it?
I think it's a lot of different ways. And I think it's always a moving target. So we did it by, of course, hiring a lot of officers from Miami Gardens, who, that's our part of our version of community policing, is that we have people from the community who are actually policing. But then our chief and our department, they do a whole bunch of other stuff. They do coffee with the cop and lunch with the cop and shopping with the cop and Pollo Tropical with the cop and Walmart with the cop and Let's Bike with the cop. And they do dry cleaning with the cop. They have all of these programs because they want to get to know people from the community. They want people in the community to get to know them. They want to have those relationships. So we have community policing units, but then we also have community policing training that's given to all of our police officers. And we have implicit bias training that's given to all of our police officers. And so it's not one thing. It's an attitude that has to kind of permeate the organization. And sometimes that's difficult.
Can we assume that trust exists, though?
Oh, I assume nothing, first of all. I assume that when bad things happen, you need to be able to show the things that you did to either prevent those bad things from happening or address them once they actually occur. So I believe that we've come to a point in our community, in our society, where people believe what you see. So if you see someone with 85 incidents and they've never been disciplined, well, then you're going to believe that the system doesn't operate to your benefit. So I think that you have to actually be transparent in that respect. And you have to actually be willing to have those conversations in that respect. And you have to be willing to have good ideas. Like one of the things that we did in Miami Gardens, and it wasn't addressing policing issue necessarily of police officers, but one of the things we did was we said, hey, we want to talk about violence. You tell us, you give us your ideas. And so we went and partnered with, you know, community groups that now help us in violence reduction programs. And so it's those type of things. It's not just one thing that builds trust. And
so
you can't just have it. You have to always keep working at it. It's like a relationship.
You talk with cops about what they think about violence.
Oh, I talk to the community about what they think about violence.
Okay.
So, and I have our police officers talk to community members about what they think about violence and partner with community groups about violence reduction. Because ultimately, it's not police officers that keep us safe. It's all of us that keep us safe.
And so, you know, with these changes you've made, I mean, you know, again, getting these conversations started, but also, again, hiring more people, more cops who live in the community. Now, of course, close to half the force, I believe now, is black. But what has that done for crime rates? What has that done for the problem with police use of force? What have you seen in your community?
In our community, it's a moving target with crime rates. And I never run or tout crime rates one way or the other. If they're up, we continue to do our work. If they're down, we continue to do our work. We continue with our partnerships. Right now, you know, crime is down in Miami Gardens. But that's not something I went around saying, hey, crime is down, because I understand that crime being down isn't necessarily a function of the mayor. The crime being down is a function of the men and women of the police department. It's a function of our partnerships with the houses of faith in Miami Gardens. It's a partnership with all of our crime watches. It's a partnership with every other thing, with our parks department and how we're engaging kids.
Okay, but
there's
what about
so many different things to actually speak to that I never actually tell to say, oh, we're doing this and it works because of this. Because I understand it's not me, and it's all of us actually getting it done.
All right, but with the changes you brought on and the things that you've tried to implement, what have you seen with that relationship between the community and the police force? And again, going back to issues of use of force, has that gotten better?
I think there is a greater level of trust. I think there is a greater level of trust with the community, and part of that is when people. Like if somebody has a problem and they email me, I forward it to the chief calls them back directly. So you don't have to worry about talking to the sergeant at the front desk the chief or the assistant chief, they're going to call you back directly and they're going to help you get through this directly. And so that level of communication, that ability to actually speak to people when they have problems, that ability to actually listen, discipline officers. One of the things that I said when I became mayor was, that I can't necessarily say that people will never do anything bad. What I can say is if we have a professional police department, and if you act out of the professional standards, we will fire you.
Okay.
And so people need to understand that. And when you combine all of those things, you combine recruiting and the outreach and the accountability, I think all of those things inure to a greater trusting relationship.
All right. So we talk about all these different reforms, things that we need to do. You know, earlier this week, or last week, I should say, we spoke with Tiffany Burks, one of the organizers with the Black Lives Matter movement in Broward. And we spoke with her about police reform. This is what she said.
We ask for more body cameras. We ask for more de-escalation training. We ask for more racial bias training. And we got those things. And so we got those things, and police violence is still on the rise, right? We got those things, and BSO still killed Greg Frazier up in Pompano. And so I think it's so important to talk about, we got a lot of the reforms, and that's why a lot of people are calling for defunding, right? Because now we actually want those resources to be allocated, reallocated to things that actually have been proven to keep our community safe.
All right. She talked about reforms that were put in place, and she's saying they didn't really work. So Miami Gardens already mandated bias training. You mentioned that. Body cameras. Do you think they're working?
I think they're working to an extent, yes. But I think you have to keep with it, and you can't do them in isolation. So part of the defunding conversation is not just not spending money in police, but spending money in other places. And so one of the things that we've done, if you take, for example, what we've done in our parks, people think of a park as like someplace you play football or basketball. But we also give anger management and dispute resolution in parks. We also have an intense investment in your mental health through Live Healthy Miami Gardens. You can't just do those reforms. A body camera will help. You know, implicit bias training will help. Community police training will help. Having officers who are familiar with the community will help. But you need other things like accountability if people violate those standards. You need programs that aggressively connect community and police officers. It's not a magic pill. And I think a lot of times, In politics and in policy, people treat it like it is. You can do this one thing and it'll make it better. That's not how that works. How it works is you have to be sustained in your effort. You have to be intentional in your direction of resources. In Miami Gardens, we've done a good job of, yes, we fund our police department, but we also fund all that other stuff. You know, we brought programming on for kids. Literally, it's up 200%, like literally. So now we give things like free chess and free scuba and free snorkeling. You know, we do dance and martial arts. Whatever it is, we try to figure it out.
We're bringing in all these.
We're
bringing in all these programs. All right. So, I mean, again, but let's come back to something interesting you said. Again, I'm talking with Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert. And again, talking about what police reform should look like.
And you so, went out.
All right. You know what, Mayor? You're still there. I still hear you. Can you hear me, Mayor?
I can hear you now.
Okay, all right. Sorry, some of the technical challenges of living in a pandemic. Again, talking with Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert, talking about police reform. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You know, what does that look like? 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. And let us know what you think. Maybe your community, what are some of the challenges you see that maybe we should think about there? Mayor, again, you talked about accountability. This goes back to one of the big things that we keep hearing, which is how do you hold the police responsible? But police unions have a lot of power. You know, what do you see as that reform? Do you think it should be as easy as saying we got to fire a cop that quickly if that's the case?
Well, I think that you have to understand what the Police Officers Bill of Rights is from a statewide legislative perspective first. So understand that we have to always operate within the state law. So when people talk about reform and they say, you know, I thought it was interesting, people say, well, mayors can change it. In truth, mayors really can't change those laws. In truth, the collective bargaining agreement, a lot of those things and the protections are codified with, and how we interact with police officers codified in state law. So that's what has to change. But even with regard to that, if you are willing to work the process and you're willing to hold officers accountable, you can still fire somebody if they violate their professional standards. You just have to have a good professional standards unit, and you have to make and you provide the training and let them know that this is what's expected of them.
But you can't fire cops. It's hard to.
Well, no, since I've been mayor in Miami Gardens, we've done it 12 different times.
Okay.
Providing professional standards. So I think you can. I think you can. I just think it's difficult. But that's part of creating a culture in a community and an organization that some things aren't going to be allowed. So I can never promise you that I can deliver a police department that where no one will do something that's bad. Because the truth is that police officers are human and they come from the greater population. And we have people out there who will do silly, stupid, and bad things.
Is it about but is it about the culture? Is it that, or is it about when you're hiring them, who you're hiring and having a process where you know who you're hiring?
Well, I think that I don't know that those things are mutually exclusive, first of all. I think that it's very possible that it could be both. And I think that you have to address it in both ways. So you address it with your screenings in your hiring, whether it's having a more intense psychological, whether it's having a better background check. Like one of the things that I would like to see, if you've been a member of a hate group any time in your life, I don't think you should be a police officer. That's my personal opinion. So if we got something that was statewide or nationwide, I think that would be a good idea. If you've been a member of a hate group any time in your life, any hate group, that you shouldn't be a police officer because you might have manifest a desire that's incompatible with fair and objective protecting and service of a greater population.
Mayor, what about this? The other thing we keep hearing is defund police. Some people say dismantle. There are a lot of different words, so we always have to clarify what each of them is. Some people just want to see budgets cut. Minneapolis City Council presented a proposal to radically change the budget for the police department. How do you feel about that?
How do I feel about what they did in Minneapolis, how do I feel about the concept for Miami
Gardens? Well, that too. Yeah, no, bringing that idea down here to South Florida.
Well, I think that every community is different, and I think that they have to find a way to budget for their resources and their values, with their resources for their values. So in Minneapolis, if they can't fund all of the other stuff and find a way to fund police departments, and that's something they have to look at. But in different jurisdictions, that's going to look a different way. So certain police cultures are different. Like certain police forces are very militarized. We don't have a particularly militarized force. So we don't have all of the fancy stuff that everybody else has. They can roll out. We have cars and police officers with body cams. And
you have armored vehicles.
You know, I asked about this. We had one, they called it a RAV tab. And I said, we paid for that? I said, no, we didn't pay for it. The federal government donated it to us. It was a grant. And we've never actually used this. It just sits there. But we never pay for anything like that. And incumbent. And so I was actually corresponding with a resident and the emails back and forth. And one of the things I noted is that when you look at our police budget, included in our police budget is the money we spend with the community groups to do violence reduction. Included in our police department budget is stuff like for PAL. Included in our police department budget is stuff for the social workers and the victim advocates that we have on staff. All of that's included in our police department budget. So we don't actually have a department of health that's central to the city of Miami Gardens. We don't run schools or anything like that. We do social service activism to the extent we can through community development block grants, through Live Healthy Miami Gardens, through parks, and through police.
And you said, you know, talk about budget. The Miami Gardens, I was looking at the budget for this upcoming year, 50% going to public safety. Is that all for police?
Well, it's all for the police department.
Okay.
But not everything in the police department. Like I said, there are things that we fund with regard to anger management, the social, those things will come through police also. But then I think you also have to really look at the needs of a community and how it's being used. So and I think one of the rushes that we have to judgment with regard to police departments is we think that every police department is built the same. So you think that every police department is going to be spending money in these certain ways. We spend an inordinate amount of money on community policing initiatives. We spend an inordinate amount of money on things to make sure all of our officers have the trainings that we think are important. We spend money before the state legislature said that people had to wear body cameras. We were actually putting body cameras on people because I said, no, all our officers are going to have body cameras. So you really have to look at how it's spent within it, and then not just look at how it's spent in the police budget, but look at the other departments. So when people talk to me about how much money we spend in the police department, I talked to them about how much money we've spent in parks and on kids and how we've increased it, because I felt like we had to behave in a different way in that area. We had to provide amenities and access to things for kids that wasn't being provided. Okay. So one of the luxuries we've had in Miami Gardens is we've been able to grow our local economy so that we've been able to have more funds to do both things.
Let me do this. I'm going to go to the phones. I want to go to Phil in Miami talking about the issue of defunding. Phil, welcome to the program. I appreciate your time.
Hey, guys. Happy to be here.
Go ahead, Phil. What are you thinking?
Well, I feel like, you know, this whole conversation about defunding is it kind of works against us, those that are on board with the idea of taking a piece of broken glass and just taking it out and then rebuilding with a new piece of glass. And I feel like maybe if we change the wording a little bit, we would get more people on board with the idea of what we're trying to do to just, you know, change humanity and how policing works and what people can expect from their police officers. And I really appreciate the work that the mayor's been doing, listening in on everything that he's been trying to do. But I feel like maybe we can change the wording a little bit to get more people on board with the idea of, you know, we're not trying to take police, like, we're not trying to, you know, whatever it is that they're afraid of, I feel like defunding is just like a blatant, like, fear-mongering kind of, we're gonna pull the rug out from under you and all of you guys on the other side. It's almost like separating the two sides.
Right.
And it's not a conversation of two sides. This involves everybody.
Yeah.
You know?
No, this is, you know what, Phil, this is a good point. And this is something we've been trying to clarify with people, because you've heard dismantling, defunding, you know, and there are a lot of different words and people are trying to now clear up exactly what they mean. As in, for example, in Broward County, they not so much defund, but they want to take a portion of the money for the budget for next year and put it in social services instead. And also there has been conversations about taking away money to demilitarize police, because as the mayor said, you know, they do have an armored vehicle. Granted, it was given to them in a grant, but some police departments are buying these things. Mayor, you know, I wanted to ask about, you know, you're running for county commission. How do you address the issue of police brutality and this relationship between the police and especially the Black community on a bigger scale, on a county level?
Well, I think you do a lot of the things that we've done in Miami Gardens on a county level. You focus on intense community policing level from a county perspective. But then I think you also have to work with cities. The truth is that counties police unincorporated areas in Miami-Dade County, but there are a lot of municipal police departments. Those partnerships, it really needs to be seamless, because ultimately we're trying to provide a safe area, whether that be violence from other community members or violence from law enforcement, for everyone. And I think you have to have that standard, and it has to be uniform. I would love to see a uniform standard across every city and in the county on what the use of force would look like. I think the county doing something like that would be something worthwhile. I would also love to see us be able to have, you know, civilian oversight that actually spoke to.
And there is a push for that on the county level.
Yeah, we have to make it so that it's real and that it actually speaks to actual oversight and transparency, and that once the determination is made, you know, we have ability to get, you know, the bad officers off the street.
And we
can do that, though, but we have to be really look to outcomes and not just be caught up in soundbites.
I wanted your take briefly on the president's executive order now pushing again for how police handle themselves and, of course, investigating police who are bad actors, as we keep hearing.
You know, I was doing another interview and he was on the television and I saw him talking for a long time. So I don't know the details of it yet. But I really try not to comment on the things the president says because they seem to change sometime. I think that if you're the president and you say this isn't going to be allowed and that's it, and if you do this, that we're going to send the Department of Justice, then I think that you could probably just make it happen. I don't think it has to be that complicated. So I don't know exactly what it is. We'll review it. I know that we will be consistent in Miami Gardens with any of the prohibitions because we're trying to set greater standards for ourselves.
Yeah.
But I think that those things have to happen from a local, more grassroots area, and we have to grow them up into the national government, not necessarily grow them down.
Miami Gardens Mayor Oliver Gilbert, I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much. We got to get you back.
Oh, no, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be on.
All right. And again, I just want to mention for those who were expecting to hear Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, she had to cancel last minute because of congressional responsibilities, and we hope to have her on the program in the near future. We'll let you know when that happens. Well, still to come, Florida is slowly reopening, but the number of COVID cases keeps climbing. A look back at the state's response since the beginning of the pandemic. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Coronavirus cases in Florida continue to tick up. The state's Department of Health announced more than 80,000 residents have tested positive for the virus, and there's been nearly 3,000 deaths. Governor Ron DeSantis has defended the state's decision to reopen the economy in phases despite the rise in cases, arguing more people are getting tested. When the global pandemic began 3 months ago, officials at the local level were the ones making the tough calls on how to respond. For the past couple of months, WLRN has co-reported a project along with the Center for Investigative Reporting to bring you this week's episode of Reveal. It's called Divided States of the Pandemic. It compares the decision-making at the start of the public health crisis between California's Bay Area and South Florida, looking at testing, the federal government's role, and when and how the regions reacted. WLRN's Katie Switalski co-reported this story with Marisa Lagos of KQED, Northern California's public media station. This is an excerpt from the hour-long episode. It begins with Katie taking us back to mid-March, just before the state went into lockdown.
It's the second week of March, and the mayor of Miami Beach, Dan Galber, is taking a weekend stroll.
I walked out Ocean Drive just to get a sense of what was happening.
It's peak spring break, the unceasing party that takes over much of South Florida's coast every March, bringing a lot of business. Ocean Drive is the main drag of Miami Beach, a city on a long, thin island just east of Miami. Galber walks under palm trees, past Art Deco buildings, people watching.
You know, there wasn't a single person, I think, exercising social distance, not one out of the tens of thousands.
At the time, most people aren't even talking about social distancing yet.
We invite large gatherings. We have all sorts of venues and an incredible amount of bars and restaurants and cultural establishments and 7.5 miles of beaches. I mean, so nobody comes here to be distant from one another.
But Galber is familiar with the concept at this point. He's heard about it as he's been watching the coronavirus spread across the globe over the last few weeks. Florida got its first confirmed case on March 1st, and by now they've reported 70. But there are no state, federal, or local orders for people to keep 6 feet apart yet. And like California, Florida is limiting who can get a test for the coronavirus.
You could have full community spread without even knowing it. It is like telling us if you see unicorns on Biscayne Boulevard, you should do something. How would we know there was community spread if there wasn't a single test available to determine it?
Without clear evidence of who's infected and where, the guidance that's available doesn't make sense to Galber.
It was just sort of advice from the CDC to not be too close together. And if you get a lot of it, then you shouldn't be in large gatherings. It felt like it was telling you to avoid bad breath as opposed to a deadly virus.
Florida has about half the population of California. And compared to California, Florida has a more centralized public health infrastructure. There are no independent county health officers. Those working locally act more as branches for the state office and take orders from the governor. That means if the state's leadership is slow, it can slow everything down. We asked the Florida Department of Health about their strategy for responding to COVID-19. They declined all interview requests, so we emailed a list of questions. They replied to some of our inquiries regarding testing. All other questions were answered with an official statement that gave little detail, saying their approach has been, quote, strategic and methodical. We do know at this point they're largely referring local officials to the CDC guidance. And Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has left closing beaches up to local officials like Dan Gelber.
And so at that point, I realized that I was not going to rely on the federal government to tell us what to do. I couldn't rely on the state, obviously. So I called the mayor of Fort Lauderdale.
That weekend, the mayors of the two cities talked, and so did the city managers.
I remember taking a phone call one Friday night from the city manager in Miami Beach.
Chris Lagerblum is the city manager in Fort Lauderdale, another spring break destination just north of Miami Beach. Lagerblum helps run the city, and what he hears on that call feels big.
Chris, I think we're going to shut our beaches down.
Florida closes its beaches for one thing, hurricanes. And even then, a few foolish souls always end up on cable news next to crashing waves just before the storm rolls in. Lagerblum knows if one beach closes, the party will just move to the next one. On a call with West Coast city leaders who are a couple of weeks ahead of Florida in their response to the coronavirus, he asks for advice.
And, you know, the answer was a resounding, don't wait for it to get worse before you decide to take action. And that was, you know, it was one of those times where that sank in.
So on Sunday, March 15th, as health officials in the Bay Area are drawing up their otherworldly order to shut down their entire region, Dan Gelber and Chris Lagerblum stand with other officials from their two cities on the steps of Miami Beach City Hall. The joint announcement comes. The two big spring break beaches will close down, effective immediately in Fort Lauderdale and at midnight in Miami Beach. Here's Gelber.
The message has to be clear to people who are coming anywhere, but namely to our cities right now. You can't do that anymore. You know, the party is over.
Lagerblum says that closing the beach felt like a big move at the time.
I think it was sort of perceived at the time as, why are you doing this and why so soon? And maybe now hindsight being 2020, we said, why didn't we do it a week sooner?
Governor DeSantis publicly supports these first beach closures, but he doesn't want to shut down the sand all over the Sunshine State because he thinks some people can be there safely.
If you have a mother just walking down the beach with their daughter, I think that can be done safely. That is much different than doing a Jell-O shot off somebody's stomach.
The day Miami Beach and Fort Lauderdale closed their beaches, Florida has about 100 confirmed cases of the coronavirus. Schools are closed statewide by now, with the governor's approval. And he also locks down long-term care facilities to visitors. On March 17th, the governor limits restaurants to half capacity and closes bars and nightclubs. In those 2 days since the beach closures, it looks like the number of Florida's confirmed cases has doubled, from about 100 to just over 200. But it's hard to say exactly what that means. You're going to see an uptick in the number of cases not just when more people are getting sick, but also when more tests are being done. And on that day, Florida reported more new test results than they had on any day before. March 17th is also Election Day in Florida, the presidential primary. Some states have postponed, but not Florida.
We're definitely voting. I mean, they voted during the Civil War. We're going to vote.
Some poll workers have different plans. They start calling in to quit a week before the election because they're afraid of getting sick. Two poll workers who do show up in two different cities later test positive for the coronavirus. But DeSantis defends the decision to hold the election.
I think having to cancel it, I think in an environment where people were on edge, I think it would have really sent a signal about of panic. And I don't think that's the signal that you want to send.
Election day in Florida is the first day those Bay Area counties in California are closed. The mayor of the city of Miami, Francis Suarez, sees what the California officials did and wants to follow their lead. So he talks to a friend.
I'm very close to, I'm friends with the mayor of San Francisco, London Breed.
Breed can confirm.
Oh my God, he's amazing. And you know, he had COVID and everything, but he was still working his butt off. And, you know, we shared information for sure.
Breed says, yeah, she advised Suarez to shut his city down.
I did. I told a few mayors. At the time, people probably thought I was overreacting just a little bit. But when my Department of Public Health director told me that if we do nothing, that this could get out of control and people can be turned away from the hospital. How is that possible in 2020? How is that even possible?
Suarez first had to make sure closing the city was even legal.
And we had to put a lot of internal pressure on our city attorney with our commissioners to get her to agree to it, to finally agree to it.
It might have helped that Mayor Suarez tested positive for the coronavirus. He posts openly about it in a video diary. Here's his first entry.
How do I feel? I feel good. I feel like I have, you know, some symptoms of what is like the onset of a cold, maybe the onset of a flu. What I want to do is kind of have a diary where I share with everybody, you know, what I'm going through, what I'm feeling, because inevitably more people are going to get infected, unfortunately.
The city of Miami shuts down March 24th. And by now, nearly half of Florida's cases come from just three South Florida counties. This is the densest region in the state. Dozens of cities spread inland from the beaches and north from Miami. In Fort Lauderdale, city manager Chris Lagerblum describes his area like this.
Knowing the geography of our city, you can blink and you're in Oakland Park, and then you can blink again and you're in Wilton Manors, and before you know it, you're in Pompano or Dania Beach.
With Governor DeSantis largely supportive of local control, many of these places are writing their own coronavirus rules. And it's getting confusing for residents who routinely drive across city lines to run errands or to get to and from work. So Lagerblum gets involved in another coordinated effort with leaders from other cities in Broward County. County officials on March 26 strongly urge people to stay home, but city officials don't think that goes far enough. They work overnight to hammer out a stronger template together. And by the day after the county acts, all the cities have issued their own safer at home orders. Some details still vary, like curfews and enforcement. But Lagerblum feels like the coordination went well.
It was really neat to watch, very honestly, because I didn't think it was possible.
Still, rather than follow the local lead as California's Governor Gavin Newsom did, Florida's Governor DeSantis is hesitant to draw up a statewide order that would keep people cooped up.
You simply cannot lock down our society indefinitely with no end in sight. That is not something that the society would accept.
We reached out to the governor's office for details on their communications with the White House, local leaders, the State Department of Health. They declined our interview requests, but did reply with an email. They offered little detail and directed us to the governor's public schedule. On March 26th, the U.S. passes China for the highest number of coronavirus cases reported in the world. And now, like California, Florida has a cruise ship crisis heading its way.
The biggest problem now, where will both ships dock?
Passengers on two ships are sick with flu-like symptoms. Some test positive for the coronavirus. The ships want to dock near Fort Lauderdale, but the governor and local officials fear they'll get stuck with a bill and with sick people from out of town. Broward County Commissioner Michael Udine is frustrated.
Why would this be a last-minute thing when it becomes a humanitarian issue and a humanitarian crisis that this gets hurled upon a local government and a local port?
This time, unlike in California, President Trump pushes for letting the ships dock in Florida. And ultimately, they do. CDC guidelines allow the vast majority of passengers to take charter flights home, all over the world. More than 200 fly to San Francisco, which at this point has been under lockdown for 2 weeks. On April 1st, during the final cruise ship negotiations, Florida passes 7,700 confirmed cases of the coronavirus, more than triple what it was the week before. DeSantis follows what dozens of other governors across the U.S. have already done, and issues a safer-at-home order to take effect 2 days later.
That was WLRN's Katie Switalski. The story was co-reported by Marisa Lagos from KQED for the show Reveal by the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can hear the full episode, Divided State of the Pandemic. Just go to WLRN.org. Well, still to come, the Supreme Court's landmark ruling prohibiting discrimination against LGBTQ employees. We're going to hear from a local trans rights organization. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The U.S. Supreme Court says it is illegal for an employer to fire someone for being gay or transgender. That decision came yesterday in a 6-3 ruling. The victory for the LGBTQ community gives them protection from discrimination in the workplace under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That law bars employment discrimination based on race, religion, national origin, and sex. Some advocates have raised concerns that the ruling doesn't go far enough. Florida is still an at-will employer state. We're joined now by Morgan Mayfair, co-founder and director of TransSocial, a South Florida-based nonprofit that provides support to members of the LGBTQ community and training to companies. Morgan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You knew this case was before the Supreme Court. Before the decision came down, I want to know, what were your expectations? What did you think they were going to do?
I did not think that they were going to rule in our favor. Considering the current administration, considering what happened on Friday, the Friday before, where, you know, basically Obamacare, you know, provisions for the community were removed. I did not expect that the Supreme Court was going to rule in our favor, so I was incredibly shocked.
Yeah, the decision comes down Monday morning. First of all, where were you? How did you hear about it?
I was, I believe I was doing a training, and I got a text message. And I immediately, you know, I read it, and I posted it online, and I started getting people reaching out to me and saying, are you sure? Are you sure this really happened? So I did a little research just to make sure, and yes, it did. It was just fabulous news. Unbelievable.
And it was a 6-3 decision. So you had two conservative judges who agreed with the liberal side of the court. How did you process that?
I think it was very logical that they would process it that way, considering, you know, the definitions of sex, you know, in the wording. They concurred that sex includes gender orientation and gender identity. I think this is going to have a much bigger impact than just, you know, the civil rights for workplace.
You know, one of the more poignant points of this story, of this case, it's about Amy Stevens, who is at the center of this case. And
yes.
Her story is this. She wrote a letter to her coworkers and bosses years ago, telling them of the decision that she had made to accept her identity and that she was going to make changes over the summer. And then she was fired. So I'm wondering from you, how many people you've met who've had the courage to do that, to be out and open with, you know, with their identity and the changes they wanted to make?
A lot. We are a trans-led organization. I'm transgender myself. I'm a trans man or a man of transgender experience. So we do encounter many, many people that go through this. And a lot of them transition while they're on the job. And they have no choice but to be open with their employers. And I'm going to say that, you know, statistics say that 30% of trans people in Florida have experienced discrimination in the workplace. And that's from a Gallup poll. But I'm going to tell you that from personal experience, I would say it's more like 60% or more.
How does this decision, I'm wondering how this decision, though, now protects trans individuals, specifically in the hiring process. There's something interesting about transparency and honesty because, you know, you may have a person who's trying to get a job and maybe they don't want to tell where they worked before because they've made that change.
Well, here's the thing. when a trans person applies for a job, okay, they have a choice to make here. They're either going to go to that interview without a work history, as though they fell out of the sky, okay, or they're going to disclose that they have a work history, but it's under another name and gender, which means that they're outing themselves to that future employer. That future employer can then choose to not hire them, can choose to discriminate against them. With this new law, they legally will not be able to do that. But, you know, this does not go against the companies and the employers. This is something that I want them to understand. This behooves them to understand that they're going to have now an enormous pool of experienced workers that they can choose from. And the only thing that companies have to do is make their companies a welcoming space for LGBTQ plus employees, which means taking some cultural sensitivity training and offering it to staff, recommending affirming policies and procedures, you know, all these different things. And it's not that difficult. We offer the training, okay? Transsocial is a nonprofit that you can reach online, where transsocial.org. We can help your company to do all of these things. This can be a wonderful thing for the economy all around.
I'm talking with Morgan Mayfair, co-founder and director of Transsocial, a South Florida-based nonprofit that provides support to members of the LGBTQ community and training to companies, as Morgan has said. You can find more of our coverage, by the way, of the Supreme Court decision at WLRN.org. So, Morgan, I want to dive a little more into this. You were talking about you sure. work with companies and helping them to be culturally competent. I'm wondering, like, what are some of the things that you find when you're talking to groups? You know, what are some of the challenges you face in trying to help them?
A lot of misconceptions. You know, we do the trainings. We give them a little bit of history. We get them to understand the community a little bit better. We get them to understand how hiring LGBTQ people is actually beneficial to their company. But we also help them with their paperwork, with their interviewing paperwork, with their internal paperwork for their company to make sure that it's more affirming. So there's a lot that we can offer.
Yeah. There's something, by the way, I mentioned at the beginning I wanted to bring up. Florida still sure. is an at-will employer state. That means employers have the right to fire employees for any number of reasons. Any concerns there about employers trying to find a loophole to fire trans or LGBTQ employees?
Of course. That's always existed here in Florida. It's been something that the black community and the immigrant community has had to deal with, you know, for a very long time. And we will deal with it as well. But at least we have laws that can protect us.
And the other thing, too, is this, the question of protections for religious faith. The court didn't address that possibility that a company that says it holds itself to a religious standard can still fire someone if they believe that person goes against their values. How are you advising companies where faith plays an integral role in the operations?
Well, I can't tell them what to believe when it comes to faith, okay? I can tell you that, you know, there's nothing really in the Bible, okay, against trans or LGBTQ people who are in a loving, caring relationship, okay? But I can tell them this. If you're a company or a corporation, your bottom line is how much money your company can make. It's about making your company successful. And I can tell you that we have a tremendous amount of people who have years of experience, okay, and are good workers and loyal workers, loyal to companies that care about them. So if you care about making money and you want to make your company successful, it behooves you to consider LGBTQ employees.
You know, one of the things that we're seeing, by the way, now is, you know, with the Black Lives Matter movement, there's almost a coming together, because now we see this cry out for equality for the trans community tied to that movement. How does the Black Lives Matter movement and the LGBTQ movement intersect?
In every way possible. My wife and I are also the co-founders of Trans Pride Fort Lauderdale. And we have always had Black Lives Matter join Trans Pride and be a part of us from the very beginning. one thing that the community needs to remember is that everything started with Stonewall. Stonewall was a riot, and that riot started with two trans women of color, one Latina and one African American. We can never forget Sylvia Rivera, and we cannot ever forget Marsha P. Johnson.
This is a major decision yesterday, and a lot is going to change in the story that we're going to continue to follow. Morgan Mayfair, co-founder and director of Transsocial, a South Florida-based nonprofit providing support to members of the LGBTQ community and training companies. Morgan, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And you can read more up on that story at WLRN.org. Well, that's our program for this Tuesday, June 16th. We don't have a show tomorrow because of the South Miami-Dade, or I should say Miami-Dade, school board meeting. But coming up Thursday on the program, how has the coronavirus pandemic changed how we evacuate during a hurricane? Emergency managers have to revise procedures. So we're going to be talking with the manager from the Florida Keys about that. Plus, the documentary Liberty Burns examines the history of the McDuffie Rebellion in South Florida and the long-lasting impact that it's had on race relations with law enforcement. Femi Folami Brown is one of the producers and was in Miami during the rebellion. We're going to hear from her. Also, finally, this Friday is Juneteenth. It's a celebration to mark the end of slavery in the United States. How will you be celebrating the holiday this year? Are there events that we should know about? Find us online at WLRN.org. Let us know.